This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman.
If you couldn't already tell by the title of today's video, I will be showing you guys how to achieve that perfect K-pop idol look that you see on music videos and variety shows and all that good stuff.
From Korea, today's video is K-pop idol makeup tutorial.
Today, I'll be attempting to do a daily Korean makeup look under 10 minutes.
Speaking of K-beauty, you may have heard of Korean skincare or the fact that Korean skincare is way ahead of everywhere.
K-beauty is not a niche market these days. Built around dewy skin with no visible pores, big eyes, and a thin body, it's become an ideal for pop stars, celebrities, and regular people across the world. The industry, built on Korean skincare and makeup products, is the result of Hallyu, exporting of South Korean pop culture that the government has helped sponsor since the 1990s. In her new book, Elise Hu describes how digital filters and a booming beauty economy have transformed the industry, societal expectations, and what's actually achievable when it comes to that flawless finish. Elise Hu is a journalist, podcaster, and the author of the new book, Flawless: Lessons in Looks and Culture from the K-Beauty Capital. And she'll be here in Seattle tomorrow, June 7th, at Elliott Bay Books Company on Capitol Hill. And Elise is here with me now. Hi, Elise.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be in Seattle.
So I was preparing for this interview last night, and while I'm reading your book, I decided I would pop on a K-beauty mask. And the ingredients I was looking at, they had things like mushroom extract, acai fruit, and this mask was promising to tighten my pores and create an HD photo-ready finish. I realized as I'm untangling this gloopy paper and I'm positioning it on my face, what I'm hoping for is that glossy, smooth, mirror-like finish all over my face. And you write that the origin of that look is in the Korean beauty industry. How does a beauty standard like that get from the labs in Seoul to my bathroom in Seattle?
Great question. It is part of a really deliberate national strategy by South Korea that started actually at the turn of the century. So in the late 1990s, South Korea decided to lean in heavily on visual exports. So that's K-film, K-drama, K-pop that we have seen just expand all over the world. And those have served as a running advertisement for Korean beauty and Korean beauty ideals. So K-beauty really has a symbiotic relationship with so much of the pop culture exports that we've seen. And when you see K-pop idols, a lot of folks want to look like them. They want to achieve the same kind of hair. They want to have the clothes. They also want to have the skin. And the aspirational Korean look for a long time, way before it came to the United States, was that glowy, dewy, moist skin that resembled kind of glass-like or a mirror-like surface.
You moved to Seoul in 2015 to set up NPR's Korea and Japan Bureau. How did you first notice the different beauty standard in Seoul compared to the U.S.?
Even on the first night I got there, just because I happened to be plopped into Myeongdong, which is the makeup district, I was already getting a sense that looks mattered a lot. There were just floor-to-ceiling signs of ideal Korean women. There was a lot of before-after advertising that showed what somebody looked like or what somebody's body part looked like before and then how it got upgraded or changed. And then there were just so many skincare and cosmetic stores, one after another after another. I describe it in the book as a late capitalism trick-or-treat for sheet masks and other ampules and lotions and creams. There were just store clerks standing outside on the street offering samples so long as you could get lured into stores. And so I got that sense really early on. And the book ends up exploring how I figured out or how I process my own judgment of myself and others.
I want to get into that judgment of self and judgment of others in just a second. But let's first talk about just the specs of what Korean beauty standards are supposed to be these days, according to the media, according to the messages that are sent to people via advertising and everything else. They seem very restrictive. There's the narrow jaw, big eyes, very smooth, glowy skin, extreme thinness compared to what Americans feel is the standard. What are the repercussions professionally and personally for Korean women who don't fit into that box?
It's incredibly unequal and marginalizing when you have such a perfect standard. The thinness in particular is a thinness I had never seen before. It's an alarming thinness. There's a 50 kilogram standard that's around 110 pounds. I, as an American woman who's much bigger than the average Korean woman, couldn't fit in clothes constantly. I'm very straight-sized in the United States. That hasn't been an issue. I haven't been a victim of fat phobia in the US, but I was a victim of fat phobia or had to deal with it in Korea constantly, where I couldn't buy clothes or people would give me the big hand Korean X. They would just make an X with their arms to indicate, we don't have anything for you. You're too large.
And like they would head you off at the door?
Yeah. Like, no.
No.
And so taken together, the long, luscious hair and the porcelain skin that had to be blemish-free and then that alarming thinness standard means that there's a lot of bodies that were unwelcome and a lot of bodies that didn't fit unless you severely restricted yourself or spent a lot of money. Headshots were required on resumes. Parents would gift cosmetic surgery to their high school grads after they got through the Korean SAT exam. All of this pointed to what I describe as lookism or appearance-based discrimination, where you are rewarded if you do achieve some kind of beauty standard or get close to it, and that you face consequences if you do not. And it frames looking good or looking better as a matter of personal responsibility, which I think just leads to so much erasure for those who will never have the body type or the look that matches the current ideal. And it floods the entire system with anxiety and exhaustion, because even if you are keeping up on that hamster wheel of appearance, it's exhausting. And then you're constantly kind of looking over your shoulder to see whether you measure up. And it keeps us in competition with one another instead of in connection with one another, which is such a deep human need. But I went all the way to the other side of the world to examine and learn about and live within this culture that seemed rather extreme when it came to appearances, only to come back and find that so many of the trends and so much of what I was seeing in terms of the physical body trying to catch up with our digital filters was happening in the United States. This is actually rather universal. And so while on the cover, it seems like you're going to be going on a trip to Seoul or you're learning lessons from the K-beauty capital, these lessons really apply to all of us who live in modern life, who live in a really virtual and increasingly visual society.
Yeah. And in a gender binary box, which is the way that most of us still operate in.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the economics of it all. South Korea has become this huge exporter of cosmetics. I can walk down the street in Seattle right now and be in a shop that sells some type of K-beauty product within 5 minutes.
Yes.
And this is an achievement, as you mentioned, that the Korean government has invested heavily in. What is Hallyu, and how does exporting of cultural products fit into decades of Korean economic growth?
In the early 1990s, Korea had already really become quite dynamic in its manufacturing sector and heavy industry, but was looking for new engines for economic growth. And so a 1994 government report indicated that if South Korea could make a blockbuster on the scale of Jurassic Park, that it would bring the same amount of revenue back to the country as the manufacturing of 1.5 million Korean-made cars. And after that, Korea really decided to double down and go hard on visual culture. And that's supporting film and television and then K-pop, which was already in its nascency in the early 1990s. And all of this matters because Korea is not only exporting visuals, but exporting the medical and aesthetic advances to get to those looks. And so you have the conflation of, on one hand, aspirational ideals of beauty and certain trendy looks, but on the other, the injectables and the lasers and the wands and the surgeries to get people there. And then add to that, in the late 1990s, Korea's plastic surgery market became so mature and sophisticated that there were too many doctors, not enough patients, which then led to the growth of the medical tourism strategy. And that's when the Korea Tourism Organization jumped in and said, all right, we're going to try and lure foreigners. We're going to lure visitors and tourists to the country to get work done in our improvement quarter, in our really sophisticated cosmetic surgery market. And they did. It's grown something like eightfold within a decade or so after they first started this medical tourism. And now when you fly to Korea and land at the Incheon International Airport, there's actually a medical tourism support center where you can instantly go get your skin analyzed for whatever's wrong with your skin, such that they can direct you to the right clinics for services.
Mm-hmm. You talk about some women who are trying to fight back against this system. And, you know, the Korean women who are participating in this, some of them are part of this Escape the Corset movement. What kinds of actions are they taking? And then what is the reaction to them? What are the costs that they pay because of their choices?
Oh, gosh, yes. So the Escape the Corset movement are a group of Korean feminists who in 2018, I think, numbered something like 300,000. They took part in what I call a general strike against appearance labor. They cut off all their hair. They crushed their compacts, showed that on social media. They tallied all the money and time they were spending on makeup and grooming themselves and just stopped doing it. Now they wear largely gender neutral clothing and have shaved heads or very, very short hair, and they are constantly getting maligned by people on the street or their bosses or losing jobs or getting uninvited to family gatherings. And some have been reportedly assaulted because it is such a risky position to take to not do some sort of body adornment or makeup or appearing feminine as a woman in Korean culture. And so they are quite brave. They're really well organized. They're exceptional. And part of the reason I wanted to write this book was to shine a light on them and really center them, because their story as feminists, you know, they're some of the most impressive and exceptional feminists in the world, and they deserve more attention, especially because the risks they take are so high in a society that really labels them and makes them outcasts for not looking the part. But in taking part in this strike, they have found each other. They have kind of collectivized, they've organized. And one of the movement leaders told me that in Korea, you know, mental health and mental illness is rather stigmatized. It's not taken seriously, and there's not enough resources for those who suffer from anxiety or depression. And so in coming together as a movement and in their activism, they have found a kind of solidarity, but also therapy. It's been a therapeutic experience to stand up against a really prevailing beauty culture and embody the kind of bodily autonomy that they're fighting for.
Your visit with the Korean expat grandmothers in Orange County.
Yes, the Ajumas.
The Ajumas, they are so hopeful. And it's one of the most sort of light and hopeful scenes in an otherwise somewhat dystopian look at the ways that we as women especially are forced to kind of operate in this, you know, beauty system. I felt like these women that you talked to had achieved a kind of balance in their 70s between caring for their bodies in the interest of health and community rather than in the interest of competition, which I think is at the core of a lot of the ways that the beauty industry can go wrong or, you know, push us to more and more extremes. What did you learn from the Ajumas?
Oh, gosh, they're so fantastic. These are postmenopausal women, so they were in their 70s or so. And I found that because they radically diverged from the rigid beauty norms around them, they offered an aspirational model for how to care for our skin and bodies. Because Ajumas showed me that meeting certain specs for height or weight or bra size isn't necessary for a meaningful life, but they didn't completely let go. They still care for their physical selves, but that care happens within a framework of community. It centers what our bodies are capable of doing and feeling, which is one of the big conclusions by the time you get to the end of the Flawless Journey. It's that one of the ways that women can be less defined by our looks is by defining ourselves less by our looks. And the way we can get there is thinking about our bodies, not in terms of how they look in the mirror, but what they're capable of doing and what they're capable of feeling. So the Ajumas, when they go and get a facial, which isn't that often, but when they go and do it, one of them says she felt blessed when she did it because it was about appreciating what her body could feel from the inside out and not what it would look like, what results would end up.
I want to zoom out. Like you said, this is really a book that's about the commodification of our bodies as women, particularly not just in Korea, but globally. And I was really fascinated by your discussion of the technological gaze. What do you mean by the technological gaze and where is it leading us?
The technological gaze is a machine-driven perspective. So we women are used to the idea of the male gaze, which is how women are supposed to perform for the eyes of men. The technological gaze is more insidious because it is how we are expected to perform for the algorithms. Because the more we spend on screens and the more we sort of see feeds and use social media, the more we sort of understand what social media rewards and likes. And social media, in rewarding us, then teaches us with what to fill it with and shows us kind of what the aspirational ideals are. It shows us through celebrities and influencers and what they look like, but it also shows us and guides us with filters. And so if you do use filters, children, you know, as young as toddler ages, are learning that bigger lips or smoother skin or bigger eyes are ideals, are considered more attractive or more trendy at the moment. And then us, in participating with that, are only teaching the algorithm to reinforce that perspective back at us. And so the technological gaze is something that works on us in really self-policing and rather narcissistic ways. And I think it's really important to think about because the more the digital leads the physical, the more we want to change our physical bodies to match those digital avatars.
I mean, Botox, fillers, laser, whatever the next big body modification trend is, you talk about that choice to use these methods as a kind of tragedy of the commons, which really stuck with me. Each individual might want to alleviate their own feelings of inadequacy and meet this standard of beauty. But ultimately, by participating in that, we are only increasing the pressure on everyone to conform. I mean, how do we break that cycle? Did you, in the course of interviewing folks and researching for this book, find any way that you could remove yourself from that cycle?
That's such an important point to make, because I do worry that the more we participate, the more we avail ourselves of the solutions, the more pressure we are giving our entire communities. So me and my mom friends, if everybody in my mom friend group ends up removing all the creases from their faces, I am going to feel pressure to remove the creases from my faces because everybody else is doing it and it seems kind of available and there and affordable. But what that does is it maintains an underclass of people who could never afford it. And then you're keeping that underclass at aspiring and desiring something that's really expensive and really feeding into a large industry. So the answer for me and the way that I've let myself off the hook is first, awareness, to actually see that beauty culture is a hustle. And it is something that really unlocked for me in the writing and researching of this book was that we are all remapping our relationships with work, especially after the pandemic, and drawing boundaries and not checking Slack as much or making sure we take a full weekend. So in the same way that we remap our relationships with office work, we can remap our relationships with hustle culture on our bodies, which is beauty work or aesthetic labor. But we can't do that without taking a beat and assessing all the ways that we participate in a larger system almost passively. Because my greatest worry is that we just passively participate and give in to this. Like, oh, everyone else is doing this, I'll just do it. Without actually kind of looking ourselves in the mirror and asking what is fulfilling and what's good for us at a soul level. And so one of the tests for me on beauty work because it's not like I eschew it completely. I'm not one of the people who has protested by just not participating. Instead, I have really leaned into interrogating myself, which is something all of us can do. And then I'm kinder to myself because what we need is just a kinder relationship with ourselves. And by extension, that kindness flows outward. It ripples outward. And then we have a kinder relationship with each other. And we're not so judgmental towards one another. And I think that's really key to take on a system. Because if it's sort of like, well, you get Botox and I don't, or my neighbor does this, does fillers, and she, then we're kind of still judging one another and keeping this in an individual realm. But when it comes to aesthetic labor and these issues, it's really a systemic problem. And so we don't need to be judging one another. We actually need to be kinder to one another and then focusing on these large transnational systems that could be far more liberating and less oppressive if we kind of take it on together.
Before we go, you have three daughters. It's inescapable that they are already starting to notice the ways that their bodies are perceived by society and also the privilege that beauty can lend you in society.
Yeah.
How has the work of researching this book changed the way that you try to talk to your daughters about beauty?
I have taken the lessons from the Ajumas, actually, and focused on two ways of thinking. One is body neutrality, which is no good bodies or bad bodies. These are bodies that are capable of doing so much. And so when I talk to them or we are in changing rooms for clothes or, you know, shopping, and instead of saying, oh, that looks so cute on you, I've really focused on, can you move? Is this functional for your daily activities? So the same way that many of us talk with boys, I am talking to girls, because I actually thought about this, and those of my mom friends with sons, they don't focus on how the boys are so handsome all the time and their outfits are so cute. Actually, it's about sort of function, and I'm trying to apply that to my girls. The other way I'm thinking about parenting is just that you can't teach what you haven't learned for yourself. So I am trying to be kinder to myself and less judgmental of my own body and my own reflection in the mirror, because I have to show, not tell, as a parent. I have to show that the richness of my life and my fulfillment doesn't come from trying to get the pretty privilege, you know, or the attractiveness halo effect out there. That the richness of my life comes from the strength of my relationships with one another, my relationships with my friends and my loved ones, from what I'm putting out there through my imagination and my creativity and my kindness or my conviction and character. And so I'm trying to lead by example. It's easier said than done, but letting myself off the hook on my own appearance or my own sort of insecurities about my appearance is something that I hope models or is a good model for my daughters.
Elise Hugh is the author of Flawless, Lessons in Looks and Culture from the K-Beauty Capital. She's going to be in Seattle tomorrow, June 7th, at Elliott Bay Book Company. You can find more information about how to attend that event at kuow.org/events. Elise, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, and I hope to see Seattle listeners soon. Mwah!
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at kuow.org.